From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Fright Night, open lines. Here's what's happening. Rough weather in Arkansas, tornadoes ripping through central Arkansas late now, killing at least three people, injuring 25 others, destroying several homes in its path. Oil from a massive spill in the Gulf of Mexico continues to ooze into Louisiana's wetlands as storms threaten to frustrate desperate protection efforts. The White House has put on hold any new offshore projects until safeguards are in place to prevent rig explosions like the one that caused the spill. As customary, Captain Kelly Sweeney monitoring the situation for us. Kelly, it's not getting any better, is it?
Well, hey, George, and no, it certainly isn't. There's a number of factors that are going on. I think one thing is nobody's really realized the sheer size of this ever-growing and worsening oil spill. And there are six oil spill response vessels, like the Louisiana responder that I was on, that are stationed down in the Gulf area. All of them are on the scene. And then there's two that are coming around from the East Coast, and they're heading down as we speak. But we're talking an area, what, the size of the state of Connecticut or, or bigger than that. Eight vessels stationed in this large spill are not going to be able to control it. And I don't think that people are realizing the magnitude of this thing. And the Exxon Valdez occurred in inland waters in Prince William Sound, a large bay, but an inland waterway. You know, this is a whole different ballgame. We have the Mississippi River pushing out with all its force. The oil, it pushes the oil off that comes there 50, 60 miles off. And then the winds coming out of the southeast are extending it in so it pushes in towards the coast, and it's getting worse.
In BP, British Petroleum, the owner of the rig, I don't think they're prepared for this kind of situation.
You know, I don't think they were either. And there's been a lot of criticism in maritime circles for the delay that they had in responding at the beginning. Now, since then, you know, they've kicked it into gear, but a number of the mariners that I, my buddies and all of us in the maritime community are talking about how they waited a little bit too long in many people's opinions.
All right. Thank you so much, Kelly. And here's the situation, of course, Louisiana getting pounded by Hurricane Katrina years ago, and now this situation with this spill. Unbelievable. A massive blizzard is raging on Saturn, a storm so large and fierce NASA astronomers and even amateur sky watchers can see it from Earth. NASA's Cassini spacecraft, currently orbiting Saturn, has a front row seat and is recording the most detailed data yet of storms on the ring planet. But amateur astronomers back here on Earth have also managed to chip in on the Saturn Blizzard Storm Watch. The data showed a large turbulent storm dredging up a lot of material from the deep atmosphere and covering an area at least five times larger than the biggest blizzard that hit Earth so far this year. That was in February in the Washington, D.C. area. Promising news for people who might have prostate cancer. A vaccine, which harnesses the body's own immune system to fight prostate cancer, has now been approved for use by U.S. drug regulators. Provenge, which is designed to be used in men with advanced disease, is the first of its kind to be accepted by the FDA. Each dose has to be individually tailored, and it is expensive. A treatment is $93,000 per patient. Democrats pushing forward an immigration overhaul with no Republican support. The Democratic proposal includes increased money for Border Patrol and drug war agents, equipment, helicopters, unmanned drones, but it would also create a national ID, which is dubbed a biometric social security card. Though Democrats insist that this is not an ID card and can be used only for employment purposes. Catherine Albrecht is a consumer privacy expert and regular on Coast to Coast AM. Catherine, what do you think? Is it going to be a employment ID or an ID card?
Well, of course, it's going to turn into a national ID card, George. You know, we are one of the last countries on the globe that is held out against a national ID card. And we know, based on what's happening in other countries, based on what's happening in the EU, that there is a plan for a global national ID card. And the U.S. is the holdout. So we are the people who have opposed We opposed this very same plan back in 1995. We opposed the Real ID plan with states across the country saying, no, we don't want to live in a your papers, please, police state kind of an environment. And they keep coming back, and they keep coming back, and they keep trying one strategy after another. And I think they are hoping that if they can push this immigration issue, that they can get the national ID card into our pockets and our wallets in that way. But I have confidence that the American people are going to continue to say, heck no, we don't want a national ID card.
Catherine, is this a trick?
Well, you know, you look at what's happening in Mexico, where Mexico now, every little pueblo, every little shanty town, every little village, you've got Mexican authorities now going out, giving them their first national ID card. It's going to have a facial recognition photograph, fingerprints, and get this, an iris scan, as though the Mexican people could afford that. In fact, the cost of these cards alone is you know, a couple of days' worth of wages for many people in Mexico. So it's nuts. And if we introduce this here in America, no matter how we let the camel get his nose in the tent, it will be a trick. They're going to say, hey, listen, it's only for fill in the blank, whatever that is. And then they're going to expand it. It's going to be an iris scan, a blood test. And ultimately, as I've said so many times before on this program, ultimately it's going to be a microchip in your hand.
How can Americans oppose this if this becomes law? What do we do?
Well, Democrats and Republicans need to oppose it because both sides have been pushing it. This is what's amazing about this week's latest volley is it's the Democrats pushing it this time. And the Democrats have always been the ones saying, oh, no, we don't want your papers, please, on these illegal immigrants or on the American people. We've got the ACLU out in opposition to this, which is very interesting because the ACLU usually sides with the Democrats. But in the past, it's been the Republicans pushing it. So I think what people need to do is wake up and realize that they're playing both sides against the middle. They're going to play the Republicans against the Democrats. They're going to play the citizens against the illegals. However they can play it, they're going to do that. So we've got to make a point of telling these lawmakers, listen, if you keep pushing national ID, I don't care what form it's in, we will oppose it. We will help support organizations that are opposing it, and we'll vote you out of office if you vote for it.
All right. Thanks, Catherine. Catherine's website, Captain Sweeney's website, all of it part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, something very strange. Undertaker spilling the dirt. Mortuary confidential. That's right. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. I'm going to introduce you to two guests who will be with us for a couple hours. First of all, Kenneth McKenzie first became interested in the death care industry at the age of 12 years old. He's been a funeral director for 22 years. Kenneth completed mortuary college in 1988, worked for a corporate-owned mortuary for 7 years, and opened up his own practice at the age of 27. Kenneth is a big community advocate in Long Beach, California, gives back to the community, donates 3% of his professional services charge to the charities of the family's choice. Here's Kenneth McKenzie, first of all. Kenneth, welcome to Coast.
Hi, George. Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. And then also Todd Hera. He's been a mortician for 5 years, fourth-generation undertaker, has been writing novels since graduation. Todd appeared in the Men of Mortuary's calendar as Mr. January in 2008. Todd is currently enrolled in the American Academy McAllister Institute of Funeral Service. He's working to get his funeral director's license. Here he is on Coast to Coast. There, Todd.
Good evening, George.
Good to have both of you with us. Now, this is Kenneth, first of all, I have to ask you this. At the age of 12, you became interested in the death care industry. How did that happen?
What had happened was my father committed suicide, and I watched our family go, you know, as a unit, completely just to fall apart in one afternoon. And the woman that owned our funeral home in our small town had actually, she had inherited this funeral home, and she found herself taking care of her ex-boyfriend, and that was my dad. My dad and this lady had dated when they were in high school. And I just thought what she did for the family, I watched her. I was a kid, but I watched how she was able to make certain people laugh, make other people not argue, just kind of bring everyone together. To kind of bring it together that we're all there for the same thing. We all cared about the same person. Now, you know, that whole story took years to figure out, but I just thought that's what I was supposed to do.
And Todd, you were in the family, so I assume that's how this happened for you.
Yes, it's my uncle's business. My dad does something totally different, but after college, I didn't have a job, and I started, washing and waxing the cars at the funeral home for cash, and then started working part-time, and they just gave me more and more responsibilities, and I found, my personality really clicked with the job, and decided to go to mortuary school, and here I am. I just graduated 2 weeks ago.
Back in 1971, my first radio job in Detroit, I was 21 years old, was working at a 50,000 watt AM station there, but the station was housed in an old funeral home.
Oh.
It had the elevators, it had everything. And I've got to tell you, there were many nights, Ken and Todd, where I worked by myself in that building, and I could swear I heard strange things in there. It really is. Now, you guys both take this job seriously, but you also have some fun doing it at the same time, don't you?
You have to. Oh, yeah. You've got to have a slight dark sense of humor, or else the job can get to you. You got to laugh certain things off.
You both got together to write Mortuary Confidential. Tell me a little bit about this before we get into it.
Go ahead, Todd. Well, I had gotten together with Ken when he did his 2008 calendar. And, Ken had told me he was thinking about doing a book and knew I was a writer. And then a couple months later, out of the blue, Ken called me and said, would you like to write this book for me? And I said, sure. So Ken forwarded me all the material he had gathered. And, I gathered it into this this cohesive set of stories that is now Mortuary Confidential.
And who's going to give me their favorite story? Let's start with you, Ken.
My favorite story, honestly, is it shows just how miscommunication can happen in any field. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter if you're grieving or not. It's just about how people can just not think. And I had a lady that came in, and there was a group of friends, and the friends were dropping off the clothing and the picture that I needed to get the lady ready for a viewing. And I really got along with this family. It's like usually I really click with families or I don't. This one I really clicked. They had a really good sense of humor, so we joked a bit. They came in just about the night before the viewing with the picture and the clothing, and we started chit-chatting, and before we knew it, we forgot why we were there, and the lady started to leave, and I go, well, wait a minute, which one is she in the picture? Because there were six women. And she goes, well, third from the left. And I go, oh, okay. And I looked, and I go, oh, do you want me to dye her hair? And she goes, could you do that? I mean, she hasn't looked like herself in so long. And I just said, sure, we'll do whatever. With your permission, I'd be happy to. So I go to the store, I buy the red dye, and I come back, and I dye her hair, got her ready. The friends come in the next day for the viewing, and they walked into the chapel. And it was quiet, and it was like, what the heck? Well, she goes, why did you dye it red? And I said, you said third from the left. And she goes, oh, my God, I meant third from the right.
Oh.
So it was the wrong color. It was the wrong lady. But we left it, and they thought it was great because she would have got a chuckle out of it.
Absolutely. How about you, Kenneth?
Todd.
Or Todd.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to get used to you two.
That's all right. George, I think the stories in this book can be broken down into two classifications. We've got ones that are kind of bent towards the humorous side, and then ones that are more poignant. So I've got a favorite in each category. And I'd say going with Ken, starting with the humorous side, it would definitely be one called The Unwitting Smuggler. And it's about this I just like the character in it. It's about this undertaker that loses and collects things during the day. He picks up a pen and then can't find it 5 minutes later. And he goes to the mall to buy, a little gift for his girlfriend for Valentine's Day, no wallet. Well, this guy's lost dozens of wallets over his lifetime, so you don't really think anything of it. He cancels his credit cards. you know, and the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
And this is a guy from Oregon. And, you know, 6 months later, he gets a phone call from an undertaker in New York State. I've got your wallet. And the whole story is about how, you know, he was, you know, doing makeup on a body he was shipping to New York and, you know, somehow got some money out of his wallet, left his wallet. You know, they boxed up the casket, shipped it across the country. And, you know, they had a viewing in the whole nine yards in New York. And sometimes out there, the ground is too frozen to bury. So they put people in holding vaults. And so when they went to, you know, pull this gentleman out of a holding vault, you know, he had had some change in paper clips or whatever in his wallet. And they heard, you know, stuff tinkling down into the bottom of the metal casket and went looking and found this guy's wallet, you know, 6 months later and 2,200 miles away.
Well, at least it was the credit cards weren't used by the water.
when
somebody dies in their house, what's the process? Where do they go? Do they go to the morgue first? Are they taken to a hospital even though they're dead? What happens to them?
Typically, it depends on the area that the person passed away. But honestly, it's more so that people want to pass away at home, which I totally agree with. We were able to have that gift to have my grandmother at home. I mean, you're comfortable when you're not feeling well. You want to be at home. You don't want to be at the hospital. So imagine on your last few days to be in a cold hospital. I wouldn't want that for myself. So hospice and having people pass away at their home is almost the norm that we get a call that someone passes away at home. When someone dies at home, we just honestly get a phone call if it's an expected death, meaning that was going to happen.
You're waiting for it, yeah.
Yeah, we go directly to the home in the middle of the night at 1 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning and pick the person up right from their bed and then take them back to the funeral home.
And when you start preparing them for the funeral, I guess you embalm them. What do you do? What's the process?
It depends on the communication that you get. Sometimes the family's too broken up. They don't want to make decisions. They can't make decisions. So sometimes you go into this, you know, blindfold. You don't know really what you're going to do. I'd rather find out if I can from the family if there is going to be some kind of viewing, so that way I could do the embalming process that evening or the next morning or as soon as I can, because the person will look more natural if we can do that closer to the time of death.
I was going to say, sometimes when I've been to funerals, and I don't like to go to a lot of them, believe me, but the individual looks pretty natural.
Yeah.
And then other times they almost look waxier. They almost look like a mannequin. Why the difference there?
It depends on the manner of death, how the person passed away. I mean, there's a lot of factors. Were they on medication? What kind of medication? Were they on chemo? But, you know, I have to say that it's the body is honestly just the shell. My mom had enough foresight when we went to go see my dad after his suicide. I said, you know, Mom, what's he going to look like? And she said, honey, he's a shell. What he lived in is a shell. And your dad's laughter and his humor went away. And what we're going to do is see the shell that he lived in. I honestly think that when I got sidetracked there. But
we were talking about what they look like. That's all right.
Even like with my grandmother, she passed away a year and a half ago. And, you know, I knew my grandmother. I studied my grandmother for 40-something years.
Sure.
And when she passed away, she made me promise to take care of her body, and I did. And even though I knew her as much as I did, we just don't look the same. That energy, that charisma, all of that is gone, and you're left with that shell. We can try to create, you know, the essence of the person, but sometimes it works, and sometimes it just doesn't.
Do you both believe in the soul? You've been in this business now for a long time. Do you believe in the afterlife?
I don't know if I necessarily believe in the afterlife, but I do 100% believe in the soul. It's a scientific fact that there's electrical activity in the brain. And, you know, when you die, what happens to that electricity? You know, the first law of thermodynamics says energy can't be created or destroyed. So there is some essence, as the Egyptians would call it, within each and every one of us, and it does go somewhere.
I want to ask both of you when we come back in just a moment, if you've ever seen something leave the body, if they talk about ectoplasm. And also, Ken, we'll talk with you about that noise you heard as a child. We're talking with Ken McKenzie, Todd Hera. Mortuary Confidential is the name of their book. Their website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. That is mortuaryconfidential.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this Sunday will be the first Sunday of the month, so I'll be doing Coast to Coast, and of course we'll have emerging artists. We'll also be talking about how evil works, so get ready for that. And of course, manning the desk on Saturday night, none other than Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. Hey, how are you?
Well, maybe, hey, George, maybe it's a part one and part two then, because in a way we're talking about how evil works. We'll explain exactly how this crisis happened on Wall Street, and we'll talk about it from the perspective of somebody who saw it coming from the inside, knows all about how the Goldman Sachs, in this case, Lehman Brothers is another, how they were able to manipulate what they were able to get away with, and exactly who are there still the responsible parties that are still getting away with it. We'll talk about that tomorrow night.
Sounds exciting. I know the guest that you've got, Les Leopold, is a home run hitter. Thanks,
Ann. He's really good. How's everything else for you?
All is well in St. Louis, going back to L.A. in a couple weeks.
Are you back in St. Louis?
Yeah, I'm here. Got a christening for my little grandson on Sunday, and I got a book signing tomorrow. So.
Oh, that's terrific. Congratulations on the new book. I've got one coming out later on. I'll tell you more about sometime.
Yeah, do that. I'll interview you for it.
How about that? That'd be great. Thanks, George. Have a good night.
Be well. All right, that's Ian Punnett. And I'll be back in a moment with Kenneth McKenzie, Todd Hera, as we talk about their work, Mortuary Confidential, on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We're with Kenneth McKenzie, Todd Hera, as we talk about their work, Mortuary Confidential. Yeah, Ken, let's start with you. Have you ever at the scene of the work you do have seen anything that looks like ectoplasm or something leave the body by any chance?
I physically, with my eyes, have not seen anything. I have felt things energy-wise around the body, but I have never physically seen anything.
How about you, Todd?
I agree with Ken. I've never seen anything, but certain times you get maybe a feeling that there's an energy presence near you.
Ken, you talked a little bit about a noise you heard as a child and how that affects you today. Tell us about that.
You know, it's funny. When I wrote that, they asked for a few questions, and I wrote that down for you. And I don't know why it's easier to tell hundreds of thousands of people this, and I don't think I've even talked to Todd about it. But when I was in fourth grade up in Northern California, our nearest big town would be Sacramento, and my mother on Wednesdays would have to take me to a special school because they thought I was either slow or couldn't hear or I had some kind of problem. And it was a big deal because everyone in my class knew that Kenny needed help and Kenny would leave for the school, and it kind of disrupted the whole class. But I kind of have to fast forward it to understand, for you to understand it.
Sure.
I went and saw a psychic a couple of years ago, and they asked for something of yours, like your keys or something, and I gave her my keys. And when I handed them to her, she goes, it was really amazing. I was basically looking for closure with my father. When a parent commits suicide, there's so many feelings and guilt and whys and why you never have closure, and you spend the rest of your life wondering what you did. And I just needed some closure, and this woman was right on. I mean, she knew things that there's no way that, I mean, she knew what was up, but she knew everything that was going on. When she took my keys, she goes, that school you went to when you were like in third or fourth grade, she goes, you weren't dumb. And my sister looked at me, and she remembered my sister was there for the reading. And she goes, you weren't dumb. You had the same gift that I did, but you were taught to ignore it. And I never heard voices, but it's hard to explain. I didn't use my ears for it. It kind of came through my chest, and it was like just this energy thing that I was off in space just looking at.
Like a feeling?
I can't even describe it that way. It's okay. It's like when you're sick and you breathe in hot steam and you can feel it go into your chest.
Right.
It's kind of like that without the heat. It's hard to explain. And that gift, I still have it. It's not as strong, but I can walk into a room with a family who's sitting there who I've never met. I can walk in and within 2 seconds, I can tell you the energy and a lot about the death before I even start even interviewing them. So it really is a gift in a lot of ways. I just, you know, back in the 70s, you paid attention. You stared at the chalkboard. You didn't talk to or listen to energies.
Right. A friend I know is going to school to be an undertaker.
Oh.
Why is it when somebody tells someone, I'm going to be an undertaker, people generally bolt back? I mean, it's not like, hey, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a truck driver. When they say, I want to be an undertaker, people kind of look at them with a weird look. Why is that, Todd?
For some reason in our society, you know, we fear death more than other cultures, I think. And people are just fascinated with us that work in this profession that handle the dead. It's almost like, why would you want to do that? I don't think they understand, you know, that it's almost a calling, you know, handling the dead, people's loved ones, and also taking care of the family, you know, to make sure that, you know, they kind of go through this pivotal time in their lives as well, because they've got to restructure their whole family unit based on this death. So it's a very emotional time, and, you know, people, for some reason, just can't understand, oh, my gosh, why would you want to, you know, be around the dead all day? Do you agree, Ken?
Yeah, I think a lot of times people just, their mind automatically goes to the body part, taking care of the blood and the guts and that part. Now, that goes with it, but, I mean, I was drawn to it, and I agree totally it's a calling. I never would have, this just, I was supposed to do this. I got interested because of sitting with the families, and I mean, they're devastated. And part of, for me, dealing and helping them deal with the death is to listen to the stories they're talking about grandpa, and then somehow interject that back into the conversation at different periods to get them to laugh, to think, so that they'll understand maybe for a moment that they will be okay again. It's just that I just try to help them pull out of the grief for a little bit to make sensible decisions.
Go ahead, Todd.
And that's one of the rewarding aspects of the job. I think Ken and I both agree on that, that interacting with the families and helping them, you know, through their grief and getting them to laugh about some of these memories they have is a very rewarding part of the job. But getting back to the original question you asked, George, you know, there's this fear of what happens after death. So almost by proxy, you know, we're labeled as kind of a strange or oddball profession because we deal with, we're on the front lines of this profession that deals with the unknown.
Have you ever been in a situation, a freaky situation, where maybe the eyes of the body open up or something like that, and you look at him and go, oh, my God?
The only thing that's ever happened, and there was a scientific reason, a friend of mine was passing away. His name was Emmett. And he knew he was going to be dying. And he goes, Ken, when I pass away, please come to the house immediately, get me picked up, and get me embalmed. I know what happens to bodies. I don't want to be like, I don't want my body to go through that. And okay, it happened in the middle of the night, like 3 a.m. So I went and picked Emmett up, brought him back, put him on the table, and started the embalming. Now, Emmett had polio as a kid, so his lower extremities were very small, but his upper body was... you know, he used his arms to walk with crutches.
Right.
When I made the small incision on the clavicle and raised the carotid artery, and you put in a tube and it has water and dyes and formaldehyde and to push out the natural fluids. When I started this process, I was just looking at him and closing his eyes, and I looked away for a second, and his upper body completely was wriggling, and it was the proteins reacting with, you know, with the body and the formaldehyde, because he had just passed away. That is literally the only time that I stopped and I took 4 steps back. I hit the wall, and I had to talk to myself, what is going on? And I figured it. But to see that totally.
It's got to be strange. Have you two ever come across stories, or have you ever been told anything where they're ready to work on somebody and the guy or the woman is alive?
There's actually a story about that I read in one of our trade journals. I think it was back in 2004, happened down in New Mexico. The paramedics mispronounced the wireless EKG machine, you know, wasn't reading at the hospital, so they pronounced the guy dead. Oh. And the undertakers took him back to the funeral home, and the poor guy woke up. you know, so, I mean,
you got to be happy he's alive, right?
I guess. Well, so.
From what I understand, you know, he died 2 days later. You know, he must have been pretty sick to begin with. But you know, modern medicine is not perfect.
No,
and, you know, that kind of goes back to 100 years ago and 200 years ago, you know, the wake, the 24-hour watching period to make sure someone was dead. You know, our culture has been, you know, terrified of premature burial.
Well, that saying, he's a dead ringer, didn't that happen during the bubonic plague where they would bury somebody, but maybe they weren't dead? So there was always like a little string and a bell. If
yes.
the person was alive, they'd ring it, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. And I've kind of looked into this, and there's never been a documented case where one of these devices has been rung, but certainly a lot of them were installed.
Why do some cultures, like the Irish, for example, have such a great time at the wake or at the funeral, and others, it's morbid and depressing?
I think it's your outlook on life, and it's really a celebration. They're looking at the person that they're relieved from this pain, this plane, or what energy they're going on to next. A lot of people look at it as a journey. A lot of people look at that they've completed their journey on this end and a new one is just starting. And honestly, I love those parties because it's more about the person's life and not reading out of a book that maybe we haven't looked at the entire life, but instead celebrating with stories and pictures and a toast and just, you know, making it more about that person. Just like you would their birthday party, it should be just one heck of a final birthday party.
Does it get sad, though, when the dead person is a little child or somebody who died very early in life?
I have a hard time with children. Children that are born but were not alive, I can deal with better, but a 2-, 3-, 4-year-old, that's difficult because they have a personality that, you know, there's bonding and there's nothing in life that prepares you for that to happen. And there's no words that I can use and there's no humor you can use with that at all. So those are very difficult.
I agree with Ken. Those are the most difficult, the children, because it's just so sad. And, you know, sometimes there's no rhyme or reason.
When a person dies, I'm asking you this out of a stupidity on my part, but I really want to know this. When a person dies, at that moment of death, because they stop breathing, obviously, I mean, do they feel as if they suffocate and they can't breathe, or is it just a very quiet, peaceful way out? What happens?
Well, from what I've witnessed in my life, it can be a little bit of everything. It can be a very slow process where the breath just gets more shallow and everything stops. And there's some people that gasp. I mean, it's just like in birth. I think it's just reversed. When you're born, you take your first breath and there's that crying and the noise. And I think it's for some the same when you go out.
And I think manner of death could certainly have a bearing on that. You know, if somebody has pneumonia, maybe they feel like they're suffocating, whereas if they're dying of something else, it might be, like Ken said, kind of a opposite of birth.
I know it's very difficult to write a book. Both of you put together Mortuary Confidential. How did it flow for you? Was it easy? Was it difficult? We'll start with you, Ken.
Oh, it was easy. actually, Todd did the hard part, the actual writing.
Yeah.
I have the thoughts and the stories, and I don't have the patience to sit down and put it to paper, and that's where I got brought Todd in because I knew he was capable of doing that. This book, I knew it, I was going to do it. I visualized it, and I just thought I would do it at the end of my career. But after we did the Metamortuaries calendar, I just thought, well, this is, it just sheds light on an industry that we are afraid to talk about, and people assume that we have hunchbacks and wear gray hair and have no personality. I just kind of wanted to expose it a little bit more, and I knew it was going to come, and here it is.
And how about you, Todd? Easy for you?
The easiest part was writing the book. I think Ken started sending me material January 2008, and the book was written about 8 to 10 weeks later. The easy part's writing the book. The hard part is getting somebody interested by it and then editing the book, because you send the book back, and then they send it back with more corrections, and you send it back. But the easy part was putting the book together, because it was a lot of fun, and Ken and I were interfacing. You know, he'd throw me some ideas, and I'd say, well, how about if, you know, we did this, and I'd send it back to him. So there was a lot of back and forth, and it certainly helps that we both work in the same industry. So, you know, I know what he's talking about, and, you know, I can put things correctly.
Does a funeral home get a body of someone who may have been an indigent? Nobody knows who they were. Does the county, for example, send them to a funeral home, or do they go to the morgue and then that's it for them?
I can speak for California, and Southern California is a huge melting pot. A lot of people have moved here from other places, maybe for whatever issues. Sometimes it's to get away from family. And when they pass away, there is no one to communicate with. So there is a process in California, and there is a rotation that if a person passed away and there is no family and they did have funds, that the state steps in and tells the funeral home that's on rotation what kind of funeral to provide, and then we continue. We've had services where there's absolutely no one there.
Well, but the point is that you still had a service. And
absolutely.
I think that's the important thing, whether this person had no money at all or was the richest person in the world, of giving them the dignity of a funeral. And as far as the state of Delaware is concerned, it's a little bit different. An indigent will, the state will take custody of the body, and the funeral homes will bid for the state's contract, and they'll have that contract for, you know, a period of years before it goes back up for bid. So during that time period, you know, any indigent that dies, the funeral home that has the state contract will handle those funerals.
How would you compare funerals in North America as opposed to funerals in China or India or other places? Is it different? We'll give it to you, Todd, or Ken.
Oh, good, Todd. Go for it.
George, I've never been to India or China. I've been to Europe, certainly, and didn't really have much exposure to the funeral industry. This is, you know, I traveled in Europe when I was in college. Wasn't in the industry, didn't even know I'd be working in the industry. And so I really didn't pay much attention to their death customs. So I really can't speak knowledgeably about, the death customs around the world.
I've seen some, though, where we have certain, like some people bring flowers to funerals, some people bring cash, and they actually put cash in the casket and bury it with the person, along with, like, a flashlight and clothing and shaving equipment, because they feel like they're going on a journey and need these items for their
journey. They started on the gurney.
I know.
Where do you get the book, Mortuary Confidential?
You can get it online at mortuaryconfidential.com. That's the best place to go right now.
Or you could go to amazon.com. Or it'll be in all major bookstores and probably even most local bookstores beginning May 10th.
This could end up a TV show, you know that.
It will.
We can only hope.
You never know. We're going to take phone calls next hour with both of you, and perhaps people can share their own experiences. And of everything you two have both been through, is this the job you love? What else would you do, Kenneth?
I think about that a lot, and I just can't imagine it. And, you know, and in this field, it has a lot of different avenues. I mean, it's like planning a wedding. So you coordinate big services and parties, and you get to take care of a person that passed away. So you get that part. You get to counsel people. It has so many different aspects. I can't see doing anything else at all.
And Todd, you're the same?
I started out as a writer and got into this because I needed a day job.
See,
so right now, I'm doing the two things I love.
I was going to say that. You're doing both things. Hey, let's take this quick break. We'll come back. We'll take phone calls with Kenneth McKenzie, Todd Hera, authors of Mortuary Confidential, next on Coast to Coast AM.